Thank you very much. Of course, I would like to thank the organizers for setting up this nice workshop. In particular, Beth for somehow giving me a second chance about a different theme within this program. But I also would like to thank the local people for making this such a pleasant and smooth workshop. It's a pity that Jens Eisert is not here. It's a pity for several reasons, but one reason is that he would have used the projector and I would have a clean blackboard now. So my talk will be about a very simple, but I still think remarkable relation between two other marginal problems. One, a classical one, and a quantum one. The classical one will lead us to Bell inequalities, and the quantum one will be a joint measurability of quantum mechanical observables, so of positive operator valued measures. And I would like to point out that there's a very, very close relation between these two things, between these two marginal problems. And Jens, I would like to convince you that this result, the simple observation, has nice consequences about, let's say, super quantum theories. No, you can think about, say, possible refinements of quantum theory. Maybe quantum theory is not the last possible theory, but there's something more. So you can think about the refinements and the simple connection will give some restrictions on all possible refinements of quantum mechanics. Yeah, this is what I would like to talk about. So let's first start with a classical marginal problem. Okay, so let's start with a graph. Yeah, so we have a collection of vertices and edges. And now I want to assign random variables to each vertex. Yeah, so this will be random variables, let's say x1 up to xn. Assume that these are discrete random variables, and they take on, let's say, m possible difference values. Okay, and then I want to assign pair distributions, so probability distributions, to these edges. Yeah, and the notation which I will use is something like this. Let's say x okay, so I and j will label the sites, and then these x and y are the possible values for these of these random variables, and the p of the thing will give us the probability probability distribution. Okay, and then there's a restriction on these pair distributions. They should be compatible on the vertices. Yeah, so let me first draw some graph. You can take any graph, for instance, the dodecahedron, which appeared in Frank's talk yesterday. But since I'm not able to draw a dodecahedron, this is my poor man's version of it. So these vertices, so we assign these random variables to these vertices and pair distributions to these edges. But now we have these two edges on this vertex, and then we ask these pair distributions to be compatible in the sense that the corresponding marginals have to coincide. Yeah, so if we let's say this is xi, or let's say xj, and if we now take the sum over all x's, and we have a look at, let's say, jxk, yc. Yeah, then for all possible k's and i's, these marginals, they should coincide.
Right? Sorry, I don't understand. What are small x and small y?
These are the possible values, so from 1 to m of the random variable. Yes.
But in living where
So this is 1 to m. We sum from 1 to m.
X and y, little x and little y, are they associated with a specific x or with a specific vertex?
Yeah, with the vertex. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I assume that some of the range of all these random variables are the same. You can use different ranges, but it doesn't matter really. So assume that.
Little x associated with vertex I.
Exactly. Yes. Little.
With x on capital X of I, y is equal to capital X of I.
I would like to interpret this in physical terms, and then what we have here is the observable, and this is the outcome of the measurement. Yeah. So this label is the vertex.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is the value of our random variable. So the outcome of the measurement in the end. Pardon? Yes. No. You can say, yeah, it means conditioned on. This is a pair distribution, yeah, and this is the probability for measuring outcome X and Y conditioned on having a look at this edge.
So it should be capital X of I, capital X of K, there should just be an I and a K there.
Yes, yeah, but yeah.
Okay. It's very confusing because Hollywood usually use capital letters to stand for random variables.
Yes, I use them for both. Yeah. But anyhow, I will change notation soon. Yeah. So don't worry. Yeah. Okay. But in the end, the vertices correspond to random variables, the edges to distributions, to pair distributions, and we need some kind of compatibility. Yeah? And this compatibility is that if we have a look at the marginal distribution on this vertex, yeah, then this should be the same for both these pair distributions. Yeah, this is the
necessary.
No, this is what I assume. Yeah, so all the pair distributions which we are given as they fulfill this. Okay, then the question is, given such a graph, given all these pair distributions, maybe this dodecahedron, when is there a joint distribution for all of them? Yeah. So this is the question: when is there a joint distribution? So one distribution on x1 to xn, which is such that if we have a look at the marginal distribution with respect to one edge, then we recover the given pair distribution. Right? Is this clear? Yeah, so in this case, I want to know, given these two pair distributions, when is there distribution on depending on x, y, and c, such that if we trace out or integrate over one of these two random variables, then we recover the given edge. Okay, there's a simple case. And the simple case is, if the graph is a tree, yeah, then if all these pair distributions are compatible, then there exists always a joint distribution. It's not necessarily unique; there are many, yeah, but we can always easily write down a joint distribution for all of them. If it's not a tree, so if we have some kind of loops in our graphs, then there are restrictions. There might not be a joint distribution. Let's, for instance, assume that these random variables, let's say, are anticorrelated, and these are anticorrelated, and these are anticorrelated. And if this anticorrelation is perfect, then there cannot be a joint distribution. Okay. And one of the first people to study this was George Boole in the around 1860. And he asked questions like this, and of course he observed that in general there are restrictions on these pair distributions for the existence of a joint distribution, and these restrictions that can be formulated in terms of linear inequalities. Okay, and he wrote down some of them. Yeah, and about the same year, just in the next century, a physicist, whom you probably know, John Bell, asked about the same question, just about bipartite graphs. Okay, he did not ask any question about any graph, but in the end, it's equivalent to this question. Okay, so now you have, we can group the set of vertices into two sets, such that there are only edges going from one set to the other set, but there are no edges within a set. Yeah, this is what I mean with bipartite, two colorable. Yeah, like this graph would be a bipartite one. Okay, and then one of his observations was that this joint distribution exists. If and only if there's a local hidden variable model for the pair distributions. Okay, so what does this mean? This means that okay, so now I distinguish vertices. Now, I mean, because we have these two sets, yeah, and all the vertices here, all the measurements corresponding to one set, so I will label with some A's and the other ones with B's. Okay, and then there exists a local hidden variable if and only if there's, this is by definition, there's such a probability space, so we have a set of what you may call hidden variables, lambda, and then and these things here, this mu and these p's, they're all probability distributions. And the thing is local because we have factorization here. So it's local because this distribution does not depend on bj. So in a sense, it does not depend on the measurements undertaken or performed by Bob. Yeah, and this one does not depend on the measurements done by Alice. Yeah, this is why it's called a local hidden variable model. And there's no restriction on this set lambda or on the mu. This is just to say that there exists a local hidden variable model if there's any representation of this form. Okay, and then the statement is that given these pair distributions for such a bipartite graph, there exists a joint distribution if and only if there exists a local hidden variable model. It's not a deep, I mean, it's a very simple thing to prove. But the point, of course, is that in quantum mechanics, if these probability distributions, they come from a quantum mechanical system, yeah, so if Alice and Bob share a quantum state, they do some measurements, they get pair distributions where there does not exist a joint probability distribution. If this would not be the case, then I think half of the audience would be missing because there would not be quantum information in science. Okay, so now we can, and this was, I mean, this of course was the main observation by Bell. Yeah, so it's not just a, it did not just look at the same question, a special case of the question addressed by Boole, but he observed that there's a real difference between quantum mechanics and classical statistical models of this type. Okay, so now we can, if we, let's say, interpret this as a point, and so if this P, all the given pair distributions, if we interpret them as a point in a real vector space, yeah, which would be of dimension m squared times n squared, where, let's say, m is the number of possible measurement outcomes, and n is the number of possible observables. And then these would be the components of this vector. And then if we ask for all possible vectors which have such a representation, then of course this is a convex polytop, and this is characterized by linear inequalities, and these inequalities are exactly Bell's inequalities. So this, there exists, this, you have this polytop. And this P admits a local hidden variable description if it's inside this polytop, and then there are these inequalities which can be violated in quantum mechanics because there's not there's no joint distribution, or there's no local hidden variable description. Deciding in the end, of course, you can ask now about the complex. So how complicated is it to decide whether or not a given set of pair distributions is inside this convex polytop? And not very surprisingly, this is an NP-hard problem. So you can easily reduce the ground state energy problem of an Ising spin glass to this problem. And then see that if you have a look at the scaling in numbers of observables and numbers of outcomes, then this becomes a hard problem, which of course does not mean that for small numbers of N and M, you cannot solve it. And there's, if M and N is equal to 2, then there's a very nice, very simple solution, which is found by Clauser, Horn, Shimony, Holt, and Fine. What they observed is that there's up to symmetries, there's only a single inequality. So of course there are many inequalities, but they're related by a symmetry, such at the end you only have one type of inequalities. You have two types. You have the trivial inequalities, which just say that probabilities are positive, and then you have a non-trivial inequality, and this is of the following form. So if we introduce now these expectation values, so if you say that A and B take on values plus and minus 1, so these are the possible measurement outcomes, and if we introduce these expectation values, then the CHFH inequality just reads A1 B1 plus B2 plus A2 B1 minus B2 is divided by 1/2. And this expectation value has to be bounded by 1. Which is, if you think in terms of locally hidden variable models, which is a fairly obvious inequality. Because we restrict ourselves to the case where the B's only have possible values plus and minus 1. So if they are the same, then the second term will vanish. And the first term is plus or minus 2 divided by 2 is bounded by 1. And if the B's are different, then the first term will vanish and the second term is bounded by 1.
So the rule about the right down these effects?
Pardon? The CHSH? No.
No. He characterized all of them.
No. I mean, he characterized some of them, but he also did not have a look at explicitly at bipartite graphs. I did not say that he solved it. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. But I did not say anything else. Yes. Yeah. No, I completely agree. But Boole was, I think, still one of the first to address this question. He cast the question and he wrote down some examples of these inequalities. But not this one. Okay. So now, I would like to relate this to joint measurability of observables. So now suppose that We have this bipartite scenario, and possibly with many, many more observables per site. And assume that the observables which Alice is given, that they are jointly measurable. Yeah, now in this case, it's easy to see that there cannot be any violation of any Bell inequality, so there's always a local hidden value model. Yeah, and the argument for this is that if they're jointly measurable, then we can somehow put all these random variables together to a single random variable, which is, I mean, all these measurements will become a single measurement with a larger number of outcomes, but this doesn't matter. Yeah, and then if we draw the graph for this scenario, then this graph will be, I mean, we have the single measurement on one side. Yeah, this graph will become a tree. Yeah, but if this graph is a tree, there's always a joint distribution. Yeah, so this means that if on one side the observables are jointly measurable, then there's always a joint distribution. So there exists always a local hidden variable description. What I would like to do is now to convince you that the converse is also true in quantum mechanics. In the sense that if you have quantum mechanical observables, which are not jointly measurable, then there exists always a Bell inequality which is violated. Yeah, so we are always outside somewhere of this polytope. Okay, there are two different cases. There's a very, very simple one, and there's a, well, not quite a simple one. The simple one is when we deal with von Neumann measurements, so with sharp observables. Okay, so what does this mean? So in this case, we assign Hermitian operators to the observables, yeah, and the outcomes of the measurements will just be this will be the spectrum of the operator. And they are jointly measurable. Yeah, so these are now Hermitian operators on some Hilbert space. And they're jointly measurable if and only if they're simultaneously diagonalizable. Okay, so now what I want to do is to assume that they are not jointly measurable, and then show you that that indeed a Bell inequality is violated. Okay, but this is simple, because if you have the set of Hermitian operators which is not simultaneously diagonalizable, then there's at least one pair of operators which does not commute. Yeah, so let's take this pair. Let's say this is A1 and A2. Okay, but if these guys do not commute, then there's at least one pair of spectral projections which still does not commute. Yeah, and from this pair of spectral projections, we can build new observables which only have two outcomes. Yeah, depending to characterized by the spectral projection and the orthogonal complement of the spectral projection. Yeah, so in this case, we have somehow reduced one can easily reduce the general problem to a problem where one only has two observables with two possible outcomes, and we can label them plus minus one. So we have a Hermitian operator such that the square of this operator is one. Yeah, and if these are incompatible, so if they're not jointly measurable, then these guys also will not be jointly measurable. Yeah. So if we solve. No. Okay. So okay. Yeah. Maybe I should put a tilde because we construct the new A's from these ones. So we start with Hermitian operators. Yeah. They are okay. Let's say finite dimensional, but yeah. They are not simultaneously diagonalizable. Yeah. And then we find at least one pair, which is still not. Yeah. And then we find at least a pair of spectral projections, which still does not commute. Yeah. And from this pair of spectral projections, we construct new observables, which are such that their square is one, but they still don't commute.
So what are they projecting?
AI tilta is being, take some spectral projection, E plus E per.
Yes.
That multiplied
yes.
by 1 and minus 1. So yes. AI tilta is just the spectral projection for AI.
Exactly. Yeah, so exactly. So we have, so from this A, let's say 1, we get a spectral projection P, yeah, and then we introduce a new A1 tilde by P, how is it, 2, P minus P, yeah, the orthogonal complement, yeah, and this will be such that the square is 1.
I'm sorry I'm being dense here, I should be able to do this, but I just don't understand the notation. How does that relate to A1?
The spectral projection. Yeah. So there's any spectral projection. If they don't commute, then of course there's any spectral. There's nothing deep here. Yeah. There's any spectral projection. Not off the support. There's spectral projection in A1 which does not commute with some spectral projection of A2. We can always find this pair. Yeah, so the only thing I want to do is to reduce the problem where we have a large number of observables with a large number of outcomes to two observables with two outcomes. Okay, so I'm trying to prove that that if you have a large set of observables which are not jointly measurable in quantum mechanics, then you can violate a Bell inequality. Yeah? Okay. So the way I want to do this is to reduce this problem to a smaller set of simpler observables.
This is my question, because this is the torque is going to be filled by a plate, but he proved that in two-dimensional system that is just in two computers, in observable, but they classical.
No, but the total. I mean, this is just one system. Yeah. And then in the end, I will add another system. Yeah. I mean, this is, let's say these are the observables of Alice. Yeah. And I assume that they are not jointly measurable. Yeah. And then the statement will be that I can add a second system. Yeah. With some observables and a quantum state shared by Alice and Bob, such that altogether they violate a Bell inequality. I'm not saying that if you're only given these observables and nothing else, you can violate any Bell inequality. I mean, you need this bipartite setup. Yeah, and then your dimension is automatically at least 4, your total dimension. Okay, I guess we should discuss the content of Bell's paper maybe later. Yes. Yeah. I mean, the only thing, this is a simple exercise. We don't even need this. Yeah. But the only point is that if you have a large set of Hermitian or von Neumann measurements which are not compatible, then you can from them construct two. With only two outcomes which are still not compatible. Yeah? So if we can prove the claim for only the simple observables, yeah, then we can then we have proven it for the general setting. This is the only thing which I want to state here.
All you were doing is trying to make a simpler set.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Right. Yeah. And then the argument is fairly trivial, because then we have a look at this CHS edge inequality. Yeah. So we introduce some Bell operator, which is now A1 tensor B1 plus B2 plus A2 tensor B1 minus B2. Another statement is that if we take, so we have a look at the expectation value of this Bell operator, we observe the A's are fixed, yeah, so they are these Hermitian operators which square to 1, and we take the supremum over all bipartite identity matrices and over all observables on Bob's side. Yeah, and then one can easily see that this is nothing but this is 1 plus 2 times the norm of the commutator of the A observables. Okay, so now remember that the classical bound for this Bell inequality was 1. Yeah, so whenever we have something which is larger than 1, then we violate it. Yeah, but we automatically get something which is larger than 1 if these two guys do not commute. So if they're not jointly measurable. Yeah, because then this norm will be positive. I think there's a 1/2, but it doesn't change positivity. And then we will get an expectation value which is larger than 1, meaning that this Bell inequality is violated. Yeah, but of course we have to choose the right quantum state and the right observables on Bob's side. Okay, so this was the simple case. I wanted to discuss the more tricky case, namely the case where the observables are not given by von Neumann measurements, as are not characterized by Hermitian operators, but the case where we have a positive operator-valued measures. Because in this case, we don't even know when observables are jointly measurable or not. In this case, how do our observables look like? So these observables are replaced by a positive operator valued measure, and in the case of two outcomes, so we have two positive semi-different operators, namely, okay, let's call one of them Q, then the other one is 1 minus Q, yeah, and this Q is bounded between 0 and 1. No, and the interpretation will be that the probability for obtaining a measurement outcome, say plus 1 of this observer, is the trace of the density operator with this operator Q. Yeah, this is our POVM for our two elements, for our two outcome measurements. Yeah. Then there's another POVM for the other observable, and the question is, when are these two observables jointly measurable? So this is the question, which was simply in the von Neumann case, because there was just about commutativity. But now it's no longer about commutativity.
So the only difference is now that instead of Q and P being projections, they're arbitrary.
Exactly.
Semi-definite.
Exactly. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. If you choose projections here, then we are back in the von Neumann case. Yeah. But now they're just positive operators, which are bounded between 0 and 1, because probabilities are bounded between 0 and 1. Okay. So now the first thing we have to do is to have a closer look at when these two observables are jointly measurable. Now, these observables are jointly measurable when we can find a POVM with 4 elements, you know, 4 possible outcomes, such that if we ignore, let's say, a pair of the outcomes, then we recover this POVM or that POVM, depending on which measurement outcome we ignore. Yeah? So in a sense, what we want to find 4 positive semi-definite operators. Okay, these are these 4 boxes, yeah, such that the sum of 2 of them is Q, the sum of 2 of the other ones is P, and they all sum up to 1. Right? Okay. So now if we can state a small lemma. Okay, so the observable is given by these two POVMs, so by Q and P in the end. They are jointly measurable if and only if there exists an operator S, which is such that S is smaller than Q, smaller than P, larger than 0 and larger than q plus p minus 1. Okay, so this, yeah, this is fairly obvious because we just call this guy S. No, since all these operators are positive, S is smaller than Q, S is smaller than P, S itself is positive, yeah, and the last thing is also is fairly obvious. So the problem we have to deal with is the following. We have these four inequalities. So it's in the space of Hermitian operators. This is a kind of a double cone intersection problem. So we have a look at positive operators, which are smaller than Q, smaller than P, and larger than this Q plus P minus 1. And then we ask whether there's some intersection in here. It looks like a simple problem, because naively what you want to do is to first construct the largest operator, which is smaller than Q and P, yeah, and then construct the largest positive operator, the smallest positive operator, which is larger than Q plus P minus 1, namely this guy, and then check whether this is larger than this one. But this is not possible because this set is not a lattice. Yeah, so this guy does not exist. There are no suprema, no minima. Unless we deal with projections, but we don't deal with projections now. No. If there are projections, then it's, again, it's simple. Yeah. Of course, yeah. There can be projections. Pardon?
The same as ask whether Q plus IP as an operator is normal operator or not. Am I the same thing?
No, why? So they characterize the two measurements. So they're positive semi-definite operators. So okay, I erase this. This Q is between 0 and 1, right? And the P is also between 0 and 1, and they are given. Yeah? And then they characterize jointly measurable observables if and only if there exists an operator S which fulfills these four inequalities, yeah, which graphically is nothing but, so in the space of all Hermitian operators, the existence of some, or the non-triviality of this intersection here. Right? Because each of these inequalities, this gives rise to a convex cone in the set of Hermitian operators. And then we have these four convex cones, and we ask whether there's some F in between. This is the question.
Simultaneous
measurable.
Measurable means simultaneous.
Measurable means that there's another four elements P of M. Yeah. So one P of M with two outcomes, each of which has two values, and if we ignore one of them, then we get the outcomes given by Q and or by this observable characterized by Q, and if we ignore the other one, we recover the other statistics. The order doesn't matter. I mean, of course, you can. Yeah.
I guess, what's your definition of joint measurability?
That there exists a POVM.
What's your
definition? Yeah, okay. Exactly. With these two outcomes, each of, if we ignore one, then we recover the statistics of one measurement and the other way around. Yeah. I think there's, I don't know whether there's any other reasonable definition of joint measurability on this. Okay, so we have to find whether there's, to check whether there's an intersection here. Okay, and of course, I mean, everybody who knows about semi-definite programs realizes that this is a semi-definite feasibility problem. Yeah, so you can, on a computer, you can easily check this. Okay, whether I can easily make it within time is a different question. Now we can reformulate this in terms of a quantitative semi-definite program by just adding some lambda times the identity. Yeah. So what we do is that we add something. I mean, we shift these Q's and P's in this direction. And if we make this lambda large enough, then there will be an intersection. Yeah. So we can rephrase this problem as an optimization problem, minimize lambda such that there is an intersection. Okay. And then this minimum lambda Okay, so now I have to be fast. Okay, so how do we get this? Okay, so now I want to find the infimum of lambda in R such that there exists an S which fulfills all these inequalities. And this can be rewritten in two steps. So one is duality. This is a semi-definite program. They always come with a dual. Yeah, so I don't have time to write this down now. Yeah, but the first step is to use duality. And the second step is to dilate it. Yeah, so we use a dilation in the sense that we introduce now a second Hilbert space and rewrite the problem in a clever way. Yeah, and what turns out then is that that this is after writing down the dual and dilating it, this problem is exactly the problem about finding the largest possible Bell violation given these two observables, yeah, for the CHSH inequality. Okay, so this is, in the end, it's relating these two problems and showing that these observables are jointly measurable if and only if they don't violate this inequality. But somehow at this point we did not solve either of these problems. Yeah, so we just showed that they are equivalent, that they are dual to each other. We can use this representation of this problem also in order to solve it, yeah, to really get an explicit solution, which I will not write down now. Just let me make one comment about the implication of this. Okay, so this shows that when we have these two incompatible quantum mechanical observables, we can always find a setup such that they violate a Bell inequality. And from this, one can show that if there is a refinement, if one considers any refinement of quantum mechanics, so any hypothetical theory which is a refinement in the sense that it might give extra information, but if you discard this extra information, then you recover the probabilities given by quantum mechanics. You know? And every such theory which is a no-signaling theory, obeys Einstein locality if you want, has to be such that the observables which are not jointly measurable in quantum mechanics still must not be jointly measurable. Yeah, so this, whatever the theory is, it cannot render possible the joint measurability of observables which are incompatible in quantum mechanics. And the only way is, there are two ways to get it. Either you give up Einstein locality, so you give up no signaling, or you are really inconsistent with quantum mechanics. So this new theory is not a refinement of quantum mechanics, which gives you extra information and recovers quantum mechanics if you discard this extra information, but it's really inconsistent with it. Okay, I think with this I would like to stop. Thank you very much.